and that I really don't know anything about hurricanes in the beginning here, so I don't need to stress that. So I'll talk about sort of the challenges now from a more general, a broader perspective in the multi-scale simulation, which of course applies also here. Then take one example which actually had to do with hurricane, but a very simple version, you would poo-poo that, tells about some of the techniques that translate directly. Then talk about a multi-scale technology or a framework, a way of looking at it, which we call heterogeneous multi-scale method, that is very close to, or could just seen as sort of one way of looking at the models like the superparametrization that you've heard about, and we'll hear more about here. And then some all the challenges within that method. So if you look at the multi-scale problem in general here, and look at the cost, the computational cost in this. So this is the type of analysis that one can do for well-posed problems in some way. So we look at multi-scale in the sense of larger scale, think of this as a domain of the computational domain, and this is the smallest scale here that we carry essential energy or carry essential, describe essential processes. And then for a fixed prescribed accuracy, whatever that would be, 10%, 1% measured in some norm, then the computational cost sort of looks like this. Let me just mention a few points. One important parameter here is D, which is that dimension here, which typically would be 4, with the 3 space and time over here. Here we have the number of waves or that we need in each direction, which is then epsilon over L. One. And this n here is the number of points you need, the number of elements, or the number of modes, depending on what kind of methods you have, that you need to get that accuracy. So here comes sort of the cost of the numerical method.
Where is time, by the way? I mean, there's time.
This is time is 1.
Okay.
And space, or time is n here, so we're thinking of that. So this is for the full calculation. Doing a time simulation all the way here. So that's just one of the dimensions here in this setting. So there are simplification depending on if there are parabolic scaling or not, but we do that here. So here is then the Lyapunov exponent of the process, talking about how well posed the process is. And this is actually the numerical one. Ideally, it should be close to the physical one. If you have a Laussian numerical method, it's not. And this is the accuracy of the method. Alpha here, it would then be a number that is larger than D, it's always like that. R here is the cost that it takes to solve the problem. If you have an explicit method, R is 1, is proportional to the unknowns. If you have a, let's say, need to solve a full matrix problem, it would be 3 in that case. Shannon was mentioned in Andy's talk at the beginning, and here is just that you need at least 2 points per wavelength in order just to describe a function in this case. So this is the best you could hope for. It's always 1 over epsilon to the power d, which is 4 in these cases. And then you have the factor here, which comes in when you need some accuracy, the factor lambda, which is there. So these are the important part, that is how sensitive, how well posed the process is, and then the number of weights per that is in the full problem. And of course, if epsilon is very large, you really need to describe all processes down to a certain level, then the cost goes up algebraically, and it goes up exponentially with processes that are not as well posed. So what can you do about it? What you have described many ways here is you find the best effective equation that describes whatever process you're interested in, and then that can be done, and that has been done in meteorological sciences from the early versions of shallow water equations to whatever approximation has been done to full Navier-Stokes together with all the thermodynamics that is needed. So this is the idea, and I will not touch upon that. That is completely outside of sort of the numerical part. So we are assuming that we are given something and try to do that. So then you can do as good as possible within that. So what it means that you go to higher order, and I heard people talk about Spectrum method, Chebyshev method, etc. And of course, you also would like to build in balances in the scaling, conservations. And ideally, I took this because Andy mentioned that in his talk, you would like then to come as close as possible to the optimal description on some process. Typically, you need much more in 10 delta x. And if you would like to have the right velocity in convection, you sometimes need 60, 80 sort of modes of points per wavelength in order to do that. So this is where the numerics comes in for a given equation. You could improve about that by adaptive techniques where you focus in on the areas that are more sensitive. Could be adaptive in time. Some processes are resolved better than other. You can be adaptive in space over there. And what I'll talk mainly about is coupling models where you have as loosely as possible, and this is like in superparametrization, couple models or different types, so that you would use your refined model only when it's actually needed. Two types of models where the macro scale, the effective equations, typically doesn't work. One is when it's localized in space. It could be also time, but here it's written in space, and that is of course quite common. You could think of some process, for instance, the very rapid and violent interaction, as I understand now after listening to you, at the surface where you have the exchange there, which is over meters or tens of meters, and then of course you have the large size. So this would be one thing. And here is something which goes on everywhere. There are some rapid process that you need to incorporate and you don't have an effective equation for. So this could be thermodynamics, rain, whatever that we occur in these cases. I'll take one example just to see that there are components, of course, where you could use standard technology more off the shelf. And that is one thing, and this is a storm surge thing, the simulation was done. That is one thing. If you can decouple the processes, and we've also heard here during the talks quite a lot of discussion that this is sort of the source. The causality is trying to understand what is the engine that drives this, etc. And one obvious example is for instance, the effect of flooding, the storm surge that come from the hurricane. There is no real strong coupling back. The level of the water and how much water has come over the land, it doesn't affect the...
What you mean is that, you know, the surface winds and
that's
various
right.
things, you
know, the surface
can run
and the pressure,
and
the other thing, the coupling is very weak. And this is very good. You always try to do this in numerical setting. You try to sort of single out as much as possible the causality within a process, and that you could save that with a much cheaper way of calculation than others. So if you do that, and then Clint Dawson at UT and other collaborators have worked on a model there, so it may be the book there. This is just a shallow water equation with given here surface pressure and the wind velocity, so you get the stress on the surface. Standard technology, finite element, higher order resolution, it's actually discontinuous Galerkin, so it's not really finite element method. Unstructured grid that allows for localization and doing this. You use domain decomposition in order to run it over many processors. Easy to do here in this setting. And then a version of a conjugate gradient method because you have time stepping. When you have this adaptive grid, then you need an implicit time stepper. Otherwise, you'll be forced to follow the time step of the smallest calculation. And this is what they've done. There's this shallow water equation and the input for the pressure and the surface stress here, and otherwise you let it run as it is. I don't follow it. This is the geometry that they used here, Florida, Mexican Gulf, part of the Atlantic. Grid typically looked like that, or to start with. They were interested in having the impact over here, so that was detailed in this case, and then you follow the morphology a little bit. And then, of course, this changes then when the hurricane comes. You see a little bit the early waves change the sea level in this setting. And then you are given as much as possible the distribution, and you see the flooding effect of the storm surge. This can be done as accurately as you can measure in this case, and you can then study this. So this is a simple thing, but I just wanted to point out.
They must have a black art of some turbulence parameterizations in their shallow water simulation.
Yeah, there were a number of parameters in there.
So did they tune to get these?
No, well, they tuned it for a couple of hurricanes and then applied it to another one. This is sort of the justification, and then the grid refinement and all that.
But they must have some exotic drag parameterization.
Yeah, that was the drag parameterization and from the bottom, etc. Was it's just a constant that was fit to the model.
I think it's fair to say that this community considers this storm to probably largely solved in the sense that
yes.
The uncertainties in predicting the storm.
Are overwhelming everything else.
Sure.
The detail.
So I just wanted to say that there are problems here that are standard that fits into our. We can just take things off the shelf. Yes.
And the fact is, these have to be very weak coupling. The coupling has to be weaker than the uncertainty of the problem. In point of fact, storm surge does couple back to the wind, but very, very weakly, and you can treat it as an independent.
Yeah, that was the whole point of this. That's good that you stressed it. So now we look at this framework then to look at that. There are methods that are coupled scales that came out before we looked at this thing. So this was together with Owe-Nunn. And the idea is then to try to look at these things in a more systematic way in order to be able to produce methods, develop methods, and also to analyze the properties in a way. So this is the whole thing. The important part here, which I'll come back to and stress, is the coupling between the macro and micro scale is to think about the macro scale, the large, the effective equation, your goal, to have that up front, and then see now when we do have missing data that is not good enough, and we need information from the smaller scales, like in turbulence in this case, then how should we incorporate that? This is an important view. And there are sort of two views on that. I'll come back to that a little bit. So this would be the thing to look for. There are all of these methods aimed then at beating Shannon in the sense that you don't resolve on the small scale everywhere on the scale that you're doing. So this is that. And within quasi-continuum method is in material science, is whatever it is now, almost 10 years old, and the same with superparallelization that you have described, that we'll hear more about. This. So these are techniques that couple, for instance, in this case here, molecular dynamics with a continuum in a simplistic gas kinetic scheme, where you have a kinetic formulation locally at every cell, as we do here with a more refined modeling and superparametrization, and then you couple that to a larger scheme. Equation V computation is another attempt to look at this in general, and by Yannis Kevorkidis, and we overlapped in Princeton, and I learned from his experience there. But I'll talk about a little bit the difference in how one views that. One can also say modern classes of ultra-fast Fourier transform again beats this because you don't need to do all the terms. It's based on sampling. In this case, you can do a FFT.
So I'm confused. What would an ultra-FFT be that's different from a standard FFT?
Well, so let's say you are given, you want the 50 largest modes or 50 modes closest or something like that out of a sample of 100 millions or something. An FFT is n log n in complexity. These are log n in complexity, which means that you cannot visit all the places.
Yeah, so they will exploit the various anharmonic Fourier coefficients you have in the gaps between them and do a special solver for those.
So you would
ignore
the gaps. They
don't have to be integral multiples of one fixed lattice. That's the key thing.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, that's right. So what you do, you sample, so it's like a Monte Carlo method. In a sense, and the final step is a Monte Carlo step of the integral that comes in and we calculate the amplitudes.
So you described a passive version.
Yeah.
So where has that been used dynamically, the ultra FFTs? for dynamical problems?
Oh, they've been used dynamically in toy problems. So these could be in homogenization or something like that, where this appeared. I doubt that in the dynamic setting it would play a role.
It looks like a statistics technique.
That's right. So it's more in data analysis.
That's why I asked.
From computer science.
The other four are
sure.
Evolution equations.
Yes, that's right. So this was just to have something. But I doubt that you could think of something as spectral setting where some resonances comes up, and you would spectral method there, which is. But I will try to look at that. But I don't think it helps actually. So this is an example how we think about the heterogeneous multiscale method in a way. So let's take a nonlinear conservation loop here, and we have too many unknowns. So we need to close it off. We have an equation of state. If that works, then we have an effective equation that should be happy. Let's say we have extreme condition. This doesn't fit completely. So we would like to do that more carefully. And let's say that we go down and do it in a physically relevant model. Let's say molecular dynamics. It could be other types of models. So let's say we would like to have the fidelity here of molecular dynamics in order to get the correct equation of state. This is just to set that up in the setting. So. What should we do in not reduced to one dimensional? What should one do in sort of these HMM ideas? So you should go as much as you can with the macro scale. You know it is a conservation law. You know that a finite volume formulation is good for a conservation law. So this is what you would like to do. You don't know F completely here because you didn't know the equation of state. That's where you wanted the extra information. As in a parametrization, you would like to use a calculation in order to get the parameters in here. So this is the idea here. And then you look back this formulation here. There are then schemes in the literature, like the Goronov scheme for this, which is a way of solving this scheme. So how do you do there? You have these average values. This is a finite volume method. So they have the average of mass, momentum, and energy in each cell. The cell here is just an interval in this case. And then you reconstruct the solution, in this case in the simplest way, thinking that the average value is a constant value in each cell. This problem, you can then, the Euler equation we had, you can solve analytically. If you have as simple initial values as this, you get the wave, the shock refraction wave out, and you can solve that as a Riemann problem. And now you know this value, and if you had then, which you typically have, the standard equation of state, just stick that value in x here. At this level over here, you know there, and f is then a well-determined process. So you can evaluate this and step it one more step. That's a standard Goronov method here. Now, if we don't know that, then we will then do some more refined simulation that takes care of the physics. And here we initiate this with the states we have on the macro scale level, with the mass, momentum, and energy. So you initiate the MD simulation here, it could be a KMC simulation, with the right density of molecules, with their right average velocity and energy at this rate. And then you run it for some time, and you read off here, as you would in an experiment. What is the mass flux, the momentum flux? Mass flux is just the number of molecules that pass in one direction minus the one in the other. And then you stick that into your formula here. So you get this from the subscale simulation. And the gain, of course, is that you do then the refined physics only in a very small part of the computational domain, and thereby you sort of beat this the Shannon estimate, because you only apply that in this. And this would be the sort of a good example of how one thinks about this.
But here you have two special features which don't seem to hold in the problems this community is interested in. Number one is you have a huge disparity in the two time scales or the micro scale, and it thermalizes very quickly to the equilibrium state you would like.
I'll come back to that part of it. And these are our features. So one has always to look at what could be done in this setting and what can one learn about this thing. Living in a math department, we're looking at what can one show, prove rigorously in this setting for these things. And that is only the case when you actually have an effective equation, so you have something to compare with. So that is not a practical thing, but it gives a lot of understanding to what it is. So homogenization theory, that is a linear theory where you have small scales interacting in a not trivial way with each other and producing large scales effect. So for linear problems like parabolic problems, elliptic problems, etc., I can do that. Simple Brownian motion, one can also have then a stochastic model sitting in these little red boxes and do that well. Dynamical systems, I'll come back to that. It is also somewhere where one understands what goes on. Typically the error in some norm between this kind of technique and the effective equation would be an error depending on the large scale, that is the coarse discretization that we had, and then the error you do in the little red box, the error you do in simulating the special process. So the analysis will typically be of this sort, that you have your macro scale model missing some data, D here, for which you pick up from the micro scale, like the molecular dynamics simulation. And then the micro scale solver needs some data from the macro scale, like initial values, boundary values, in the little red box simulation. Together, they then form a closed set of approximations. In theory, then compare with a true effective equation or homogenized equation and its discretization. So these two guys are the ones you compare. And if you have stability here, you can see this as a perturbation of this problem. And then this gives you the estimate where C comes from the stability, this comes from the error you make in the comparison effective equation on the macro scale. And here you have the error in the data estimation, that is from using this process, mainly this micro scale equation, to produce the data versus for the same data using the effective Hamiltonian or whatever it is.
Quick question.
Yeah.
When you say H to the power of P is the expected error from your macro.
Yes.
That is in the sense of classical convergence.
Yes.
Now, if you have, in fact, a non-trivial multi-scale problem,
yeah,
the data on the coarse grid are nowhere close to smooth.
Yes.
Which means the kind of order estimate based on Taylor expansion or so, that's basically out the window. So how can you say H to the power P means anything in that context?
Well, here it is that the H to the power P actually refers to the error you make in the effective equation, which I assume is smooth. If it is not, this would then, of course, be reduced as long as you are in that function class. But that is as solving any problem. For instance, this would be smooth, the Euler equation, because shocks develop, and therefore you don't get the error there. It depends on the norms, etc. So this is just sort of the macro scale living by itself.
So in which case, the error is actually dominated by EHMM.
Yes, that usually it is. That's the costly part of this thing. So if you look at an elliptic problem where you could do such analysis, so here you have, let's say, an elliptic problem. Here you have oscillatory coefficients. And so this is one where you could analyze. I just do that to see that another kind of approximation, which is how you would sort of, from a broad sense, see this coupling in this case. So here, if this is either statistically depending on the second parameter or let's say periodic, so if epsilon is small and A is periodic in the second variable, it becomes highly oscillatory when epsilon goes to zero. And this fits well into the homogenization theory for elliptic operators. So you know that there exists an effective problem in this case. So the idea here is to approximate this unknown effective equation. So you would like to have a stiffness equation by considering using constrained microstate simulation. Constrained here means, as we did in the earlier case, when you started off the molecular dynamics simulation, you use the densities from the coarse scale. And this is an important thing here. So what you do is you take this full problem, you divide it up in the coarse scale, and then when you force the small scale to follow the larger scale, this would be the small scale simulation. The approximation made is that you don't do that over the full finite element cell, but you do it close to the Gauss points. And the constraint here is that the gradient in this second order elliptic problem, the gradient, average gradient over the microscale simulation should match the gradient over the macroscale simulation. So here it is. This, in the earlier case, there was a fluxus that we did. Here it's a stiffness matrix that we go in and do a microscale simulation in order to get in this case. And then, depending on the setting dimension, whether it's periodic, whether you know the period, whether it's random, etc., you can get a rigorous error estimate in this case, based then on the theory of homogenization and in these different cases, where this then is the finite element approximation on the core scale, and this error comes from the localization process, can then be estimated. Delta is the size of the small domain here. So the convergence is not, and I've been involved with Anna's work and others in this community are using sort of this idea. So that's sort of the setting we have in this. And we've tried it out in a number of cities with collaborators to Wayne and myself. And if we look at this, so this would, for instance, be a calculation of elliptic elastic problem where you have a heating and you have expansion due to heating. So you have a plate here, 2D, and you heat it up in the middle. And here is the heat distributed. And let's say you don't know about the effect on the expansion and the conductivity. So you, at every point here, you do a little constrained molecular dynamics simulation, because you cannot use full periodicity because you have gradients there, so you subtract the gradients off. And with thermostats in order to control the energy. And then you can run it and you can see how the small errors and expansion is and how this then the temperature spreads out in this thing. So this is completely based just on MD and some empirical potential, and you can then get the effective equation on the large scale numerically. This simulation where you have a two-phase flow, and this is so you have an interface in a pipe, and you have a boundary here. You do Navier-Stokes calculation. It doesn't work, of course, at the slip line over here, because otherwise this could get stuck. So you are interested in see how this slip behaves. There are empirical rules for the wetting angle here, and for the slip line here. But you could also go down and do a full molecular dynamics locally here. So this is what was done over here. So you do that in every time step, you go back and forth, you use the data for the shear stress and the velocity from the inner flow, and you get the angle and how it moves from the microscale simulation. This is something that one could think of in a setting using close to the boundary, the interface with the water. This is a detonation wave where the passive convection was done on the macroscale, and then locally here, the full chemistry was used just at very localized points over here. In this case, dynamical system. This is epitaxial growth. It was initiated from here, from the group here, where you on the macro scale have a diffusion equation describes the island growth here on the deposits on the substrate with level set formulation. And on the micro scale, that is locally here, you do a kinetic Monte Carlo simulation in order to get the velocity, depending on how the lattice fits. So all of these models are of the type where you use more refined physics, and you can then simulate on the larger scale with the fidelity of the physics on the smaller scale. All of them also do have nice scale separation in this thing. So that is, of course, one of the main challenges.
Have not a large number of Lyapunov exponents on the large scales.
Yes.
So what Rupert was mentioning is even the coarse grain problems in atmospheric science have enormous instability and Lyapunov exponents.
So let me just say a few new techniques that are needed in this setting. So you need to do reconstruction, and that is important in your setting over here also. Boundary condition and then how to estimate the data may be easier. So the reconstruction is, of course, here. How do you start this off? And then in the superparametrization, I am not sure whether you restart or whether you calculate, use losing the day. You don't do the restart. Okay. So this is, I think, if one can do that, that is an important thing. And I do think it is possible in this case. Here, of course, in the simulation we had, that was quite easy because you could start with matching the mass momentum and energy closest then, and then it relaxes to a equilibrium, quasi-equilibrium state within a reasonable time, so you could do estimates on that. That is a difficulty, and comment a little bit about that. I think that is a very crucial state one needs to be able to do in some way. So the question is, how do you constrain a simulation here in order to get this? Because you gain so much if you don't need to carry that. And then it's hard to impose the macro scale which you need to do in the setting. Boundary conditions, here, if you have gradients, if you want to put something in, is very important. In many simulation in superparametric, say you use periodicity, I would assume, and this is what you do in molecular dynamics, but you constrain it so that gradients, so that these types of effects comes in. So you subtract that out, and that may also be important. In certain cases where you have radiation, you need sort of absorbing type boundary condition, or no reflecting boundary condition, or which are very similar to what was used in meteorology in the very early day, mushy zones, the ends of local limited area forecasting. Then the data estimation here, and that is where you get the data out to the macro scale model. Sometimes you need to average, you can do ensemble averaging. You have to wait a little bit until certain processes has has sort of matched the quasi equilibrium state, and then you could do that. If that's not the case, if you need to carry information, so I'll come back then in the OD case, of details into that, that is a very important part of the research here in order to understand how to do that. If they are nice dissipating processes, then I heard sometimes that there's strong forcing and strong dissipation going on here, then everything is fine. That's easy, but when it's not, when there are sub-grid phenomena on the macro scale, that needs to be described, then one needs to do that here.
So on these problems too, I guess the hypothesis is that the problem is too rich to just do this all ahead of time.
Yes, sure.
That's yeah. Yeah.
Well, this is here, concurrent or sequential.
Okay.
So, and that is just a matter of cost. It's not deeper than that. This, I talked about concurrent simulation when you go back and forth. So for instance, if it is not rich, let's say you have a conductivity only, and you know from physics experiment or math that conductivity only depends on temperature. Then you should run it in the beginning and do the microscale simulation, tabulate the conductivity number then, or function. It's a function of one variable, temperature. You do that instead of imposing this in the four-dimensional space. If you take the detonation point, you have 30 species that interacts. It's much better to then discretize it, do it on the fly in the three-dimensional space because it's just surface and time. And do that instead of trying to tabulate a function in a 30-dimensional space. So it is just the question, as you said, how rich it is. It's not deeper than that. And so that is an important part. When you can do it sequentially, when you do pre-calculation, fine, once you do that. If not, one does it interactively. The same kind of techniques to initialize and do that is needed in both cases. So it's and to isolate it, so that is it. As in the theory here, scale separation is needed, and in a sense, the scale separation in superparametric comes from the form of the atmosphere that it's so thin and so wide in this case. And in the type A problem, if something happened locally, that is, well, I've had two problems where the microscale was local or when it was not, and then this was, then you don't need that. But if you have it everywhere, then you need it for the theory. So it's a question when you start to violate that and what you could do there. That's a very interesting area for doing that.
Do you have any results in any model?
No, it's in the OD setting where we have some things of that sort. In that
I was thinking for spatially extended
Nesting
systems.
Yes, yeah. So
the reality, though, is sometimes I always find our community speaks with two minds on this, because we always say we don't have scale separation.
Yes.
But all the standard practices we use assume scale separation.
Yeah.
But then when someone proposes something new that requires scale separation, we say, but there's
no
scale
no,
separation.
No, no,
so, I claim there isn't scale separation.
Yeah,
I
no,
talk
that's a different
that.
Take on it. But
my talk was going to
yeah.
Okay, so how to view this top down, bottom up? What we mean here is if we go from sort of the core scale down and use refined scale. You don't need to go down here, but as I go through microphysics, then you actually have certain processes like when droplets are in the air that are smaller, but they will be somewhere here anyway still. Or whether you say I have one method, an MD here, and I would like to stretch it out to be in work a little bit over longer times. The top-down is sort of standard. You have a physical process, and you try to get unknown quantity measured, or pre-computed, or doing it sequentially as we do over here. So this is a way. But bottom-up, which for instance is a way when you see, I do have my microsolver, and I would like it to work all over. And usually that's much harder in a sense. As in a little bit discussion with David over here when it comes to superparametrization, originally it was very much a top-down model. I had the convective transport that I wanted the parameters for that, and I do a microscale simulation in order to feed that in. Now they're looking at, I have these calculations on the microscale, and I would like them to communicate in some way. And that's much harder, because communicating in some way is not so obvious if you don't have a global view on that. And this was sort of the difficult way where Yannis thought about it from a bottom-up way. And that made it, you had these local simulations in space and time, and then we tried to combine it with some interpolation. It never worked. It worked in the earlier stages because in time you can extrapolate that. They call it the extrapolation method. Beginning. So that is harder. Many of the ideas are very much the same, but it's harder if you don't have the macro scale, because that's where your well-postedness, that's where your connectivity comes from, and then feed in the micro scale. So I think one should have that in mind.
His equation free and the equation free modeling is just no macro scale equation. So
that's
he's trying
right.
to evolve
yes,
a macro
yes,
scale.
That's right. So you do
micro scale,
and then you say, how should I scramble these guys so that they work?
Yeah.
And in space, it's very difficult. In time, it's also hard because, so if you take one of the pitfalls, in time, if you do extrapolation, one linear extrapolation works fine. It's the Euler method on the macro scale. If you do higher order extrapolation, it suddenly doesn't work. Because as a macro scale solver, it is ill-posed. It doesn't satisfy the Dahlquist condition in this case. So therefore, it's much better to think about the macro scale. What are the well-posed processes on the macro scale? And then fill in the data.
Actually, that's not entirely fair, just characterizing what he proposed. I mean, he did propose sort of a macro scale approach. He did assume macro equations, but he assumed more strongly that they would be dissipated, strongly dissipated.
Yeah. Yes.
And therefore, this notion that for forward order it's not going to work.
No, I said it works for forward order.
Right,
but if you do higher order, even if it is dissipative, it doesn't work.
He just had
yeah.
a lot of caveats.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah
but again, compared
yeah.
to what the community is interested in here,
yes.
Yannis Kavarkidis is interested in problems where the large scales have maybe a few
yes.
a few
yeah.
modes on the real axis
yes.
and everything else very stable.
That's
yeah.
right.
Very
but even,
stable.
Even with that, if you would do higher order extrapolation, it doesn't work.
I see.
So
that's
this
a
is a
point.
Way of doing it, and of course talking to him was a way where we started interested in that. But the idea is this is a point that is important: how you do that, how you design these things. And in the earlier days, when he talked about it, he called it the extrapolation method. This was not understood. Of course, he does that
right.
now. Yeah. But that's another point of it: you cannot do oscillatory things. Important is to choose the right macro scale variables here. Sometimes it's given by physics as mass, momentum, and energy very much there, and over here. But if you then would like to, and maybe we get that also in David's talk a little bit, you would like to have some statistics, some other information carried over on the macro scale or having interaction there, then what are these guys? And for dynamical system, we start to know that fairly, and now I just briefly through. So I look at the dynamic system, and the stiffness here comes from the fact that you have a large Lyapunov exponents in some large eigenvalues. So this way, a guy, I would say, they are not positive real part, then you can't do anything. So this would be a stiff problem. So these could be either rapidly damping or oscillatory. And the oscillatory part is higher, the harder. And this is sort of the standard Kapitsa, this physicist, Nobel laureate actually, not for the pendulum. So he had this example where you vibrate this rapidly, this would be good for the Academy of Sciences field. And rapidly vibrate this thing here, and then it becomes stable and swings back and forth up here. This you have to solve on the micro scale, because otherwise it falls down if you do this too slowly. So you have to, you cannot rescale that trivially. But the question is, do you need to do that all the time? This would be a solution. You have small oscillation, and then you have the large swings back and forth, and then rapid small oscillations when it does that. So this has been sort of our model in this setting. The algorithm here, and this is precisely, to a large extent, what it's a little bit different actually, what Yanis and Geer has done. You have small calculation, and then you take a large step. Difference here is we look at the average force over this setting, which makes averaging oscillation. And what they typically would do is that they take values here and extrapolate in time here. So this would be the difference. But the setup is what Yanis and Geer did in the setting. But then this generalizes oscillatory states. So you could, for instance, do a moon spinning around the Earth, spinning around the Sun, by doing bursts of calculations on the moon detail, and then skip to some later time. And here, you just freeze the state and take it over with certain constraint. And that's the important part, which would be how do you start off the microscale simulation in this case. And this is more details on how you do the averaging, the kernel, I skip that. And you can prove certain things which should be under certain sets of you get convergence by this process under certain assumptions on the dynamic systems. Yeah.
So I was curious about long time behavior. Usually you have some adiabatic invariance maybe in the kind of problem you put down.
Yeah.
And have you guys run things for extremely long times
and
seen whether your methods do a good job consistently?
For simple systems, there you can pin it down. Then it does as good as that. But for other systems, when you have this sort of very long-range stochastic inference, that
comes in sort of not
on the order one scale, but or the order one over epsilon scale.
Or longer.
We don't know that, or longer, that's right. These are important factors which we don't have addressed yet in the setting. And that's right. I don't know, Eric. So then one can prove convergence here by using the constraint and the theorems that exist in these nonlinear settings. So it's possible. So let me tell you a little bit. Yeah, sure.
Quick question also. When you showed this example with the moon.
Yes.
Where you say you do a stretch of rapid complications and then you skip.
Yes.
In this context, is there any way to, over the long distance, transport the phase information?
Yes, so the phase information over the long distance is not, in that case, so relevant.
No, I know that.
Yeah.
This is clear.
Then we just freeze it. But let me come to this example and see how you deal with the phase information here. And how you deal with the phase information.
Yeah,
if there is resonance, then you need to do that. And in the pendulum it is. The pendulum moves and it has to resonate correctly with the oscillator in this case. So the idea how to do this here, and that is something that one could think of in the setting over here, is that we do have these bursts of microsteps over here. where you do detailed calculation, and then you take a large macro step in the setting over there. You lose information, the phase information you said. There's no way you could do that, because otherwise you would solve it accurately on the macro scale. So what happens is that you end up wrong. So you do have the phase information, and you come up, if you just keep the values that you have and move the average or something like that at the macro scale, and here we had the average forces. Those were calculated in here. So we move it up. And then if there is some resonance that should be there, what happens is that afterwards the unconstrained simulation would give us a wrong average. It would give an average potentially that happens over here. So what you need to do is that, like implicitly, you need to force, constrain the simulation. And that we do by having a couple of iterations in a nonlinear fashion to match the averages or to match the energy or some other component that is important on the scale. You cannot just blindly continue. A very good point here from both of you. So you have to do that. So therefore it becomes a solver over here. And if I would guess here in a superparametrization case, one would then try to start off the turbulent simulation in a way that the important modes or that you can predict from the macro scale solver should be matched. You should force the simulation to follow those in a sense. And that is some simulation that Henshaw and people have done is that if you have enough of the leading modes or the larger modes and you force it in this way to follow that in the micro scale simulation, the minor modes. This was incompressible homogeneous turbulence.
This is slaving, basically.
Slaving, that's right.
You go near the Kolmogorov dissipation range, those modes get slaved to the.
And in those calculations, which was, I think, 500 by 500 by 500 modes, you needed 7.
But especially in decaying turbulence, I suspect that was decaying turbulence.
Yes, it was decaying 3D turbulence. Yeah.
And that's what happened.
Yeah. And so this is crucial to understand. We do it in simple ODEs here. We have to start somewhere. But I think it has implication in this setting and how to do that if one wants to reinitialize. And
I can rephrase that in a hurricane kind of case.
Good.
If we have a small vortex forming in one of the defined domains, how do we translate that vortex into neighboring?
That is hard. If you have a front or a small vortex or some like we had over there, then you have to deal with that on the macro scale in some different way. You have to trace that as we did, let's say, in the epitaxial growth. You have a macro scale formulation of the propagation. If you have a number of small vortices that interact in a more random way, then you could treat it as a field with a distribution. But if you have one vortex that travels, then you have to trap, you don't need to trace the details, but enough details of it on the macro scale. But you cannot leave it there because it will not suddenly appear in the micro scale.
You have to identify that as a feature.
That's correct. That's correct. We have to do that. Sure. There's no way around that. So these are examples that one can do oscillating strings, or you can have sort of baby.
So here's your resonance examples.
Yes.
Right here?
Yes, this is the resonance was one, and this one here also, whereby by constraining. So these are two beads that oscillate rapidly, and then they move larger. So this would be sort of a baby model for something like, let's say, proline folding, the simplest word. These are just empirical potentials. You have forces for bending and forces for torsion, and they then collapse. One of them, I forgot which, is then an HMM simulation, and another is a simulation using the microscale all the time. And the folding itself here is correct. The details are not correct here. This is more speculative than anything. I want to put in one thing here. How would one look at this? This I just did now, we have for fun. I don't know anything about this. But since I heard so much about it, so the ideal thing.
Nobody else does either.
Yes. If you come from outside, so these are just two ideas that I thought. If you come from outside, this is the space you live in, the full atmospheric state space. You know where you start, and I've learned the hurricanes. At the first lecture was well defined what a hurricane is. You just take a general circulation model, and you whether it hits or misses, you get a hurricane or not during these 10 days. Of course. The observed state is a very low dimensional estimate of what the real atmosphere looked like, so you really have, at best, PDF. Your solver is not accurate, doesn't take a lot of processing in account, so you have a lot of uncertainty there. So what you really have is an ensemble simulation that you can have, and then you would see whether that hits or not. Too hard, it seems, to do it to full emergence today. So what you do is that you know, depending on shear, humidity, temperatures in water, etc., you have some area where the probability of developing a hurricane is much larger than it would be in general. This is, as I see, what is going on today in some way. So the question is, could one do a little bit better? And from outside, I would suggest the following thing, that which is done very often, that you do important sampling on the way. And this requires that you can reinitialize, as we talked about in the simulation, states. Yeah.
That's what they do with data assimilation all the time.
Yes, but do they do it here? I just talked to some people when they look at storms over and do they?
I mean, 95% of the labor in a simulation is data assimilation.
Yeah, but during the run, do they restart the runs if they're close to this?
I don't know that much about it.
They're beginning to do that. So I talked about some people.
He's done weather prediction in general.
Okay.
Especially
yeah.
Hurricane for the ensemble.
Yes. So you real ensemble. So the idea would be to do this, but that requires a good way of starting off. Yeah. Okay.
So but nobody is currently adaptively looking at the ensemble simulation and saying there might be something interesting here. Let's receive the ensemble.
Yeah.
That is not being done.
Yeah, that's a receiving.
On the fly.
Well, okay. Because that's
okay.
So in many other cases,
nothing.
This is what one does. And I wonder whether it has a place here. Just off the board. The other thing is, which is done very much, is that I do have this representative for by my distribution of the atom. And instead of just running it forward, saying, does it develop a hurricane or not, I say, how much do I need to violate this? How much energy do I need to push in, whatever that means over here, in order to become a hurricane? So this is a sort of optimal control idea to this, and it's done very much in different kinds of methods in material science, that instead of asking if I start here, will I hit the hurricane, I start here and I say I will hit the hurricane, but how much do I need to force my model to do that? And if you are close and to the mode there, then you can prove for a simple linear system that the force, the probability of hitting that is then given by the force or control, the energy of that, the L2 norm essentially of that. So this is what you do. So you look at two-point boundary well problem in time and say, what is the cost? And that is then related to the probability. How much more humidity, how much more temperature, how much more shear, whatever it is, do I need to put in order to get that? I don't know what it means, but this is the way of reducing variance substantially in a large class of water. One case
the problem is the phase space is gargantuan here.
Yes.
And you've got
these
hurricane embryo places
yes.
are huge basins.
Yes. But some molecular dynamic simulations are very complicated energy fields.
Hey, you do this with an adjoint.
You could do this one way of estimating it. That is one of the
right.
processes in doing that. That's true.
Most often this is done in posteriori. A forecast is missed, and the question is, what was the forecast sensitive to? What could have been done to actually make an accurate forecast?
Yeah, so I've used it in a neutron transport case in order to estimate in a very special place what the flux would be or the energy of this. And instead of just doing Monte Carlo, seeing whether it is or miss, when you are in the neighborhood that you determine here, you calculate the probability of a collision and then a probability of that collision hitting this. You integrate over this this pathway and reduce sort of the variance with the factor of 100 in this particular case. So this was a simulation. And this would be similar. You have a path and you would say how much does it take to violate this to come in. Okay, conclusion, I'll skip those. Everybody had some hurricane. I don't know anything about it.